The following program is produced and furnished in conjunction with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement, which is entirely responsible for its content.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Now your host, Roger Waldron.
Today my guest on Off the Shelf is Tom Davis. Tom is a director of federal government affairs at Deloitte, a former congressman from the 11th District in Virginia, Northern Virginia, included my house in his district. Yeah. So, and we're going to be talking, as Tom is one of the leading experts on election politics, national politics, and being able to analyze and look at what happened and the trends and what it all means and how it, why it happened. At least I think we all can talk about that kind of stuff. Yeah. So, Tom, I'm just going to ask you, what can you talk about the election, what happened with Trump?
Look, we knew all along this was a change election. It was very clear that the voters were angry. We saw this in the Democratic primary with Bernie Sanders, who never run as a Democrat before,
right.
Winning a number of states for the Democratic nomination. And a lot of that's a protest vote. And, of course, the advent of Donald Trump on the Republican side. And the number two Republican was Ted Cruz, who was hardly establishment. So there was a huge anti-establishment change vote out there. The real question was, once Donald Trump was nominated, was he too unconventional? Did people want to make that kind of change? And, the last weekend, as people made up their mind and fell in line, and that's the direction that they went. We also have, precedentially in this country, only once has a party been given a third term since World War II. We are acting now as if it's a parliamentary system. The voters are splitting their tickets less than at any time in the last 100 years. They are voting party, not person. And as a result of that, members come to Washington and they behave like it's a parliamentary system. And that simply means the president's party in Congress is an appendage of the executive branch. They're really not an independent group. They tend to under-investigate their own party, over-investigate the other party. But you had that change element, and the question all along was Donald Trump too much of a change? Was his language kind of too outside the bounds and the norms and everything else? And we find out here in Washington, we're in a bubble that compared to the rest of the country, that the mood for change was very, very deep and resonated, and the end result is you not only have Donald Trump, you have a Republican Senate and a Republican House. This is the first time since really 2002 you've had that.
Right. I have to say, the bubble, observation, it's a real life thing for me. My family all live in New England and they live in New Hampshire and Maine. And, when Trump's running the primary and all this, and we're in the bubble, no, he can't. He's too unconventional. He says really interesting things. My brothers, we're all on board because they're very frustrated. One of them's a CPA, does a lot of work with small businesses up in New Hampshire. And, the issue of trade and impact on jobs, I mean, he felt that from his clients. And you could really sense the frustration.
I think that's exactly right. I always said putting up a Trump sign in my neighborhood would have been akin to a hate crime. People take it personally. I was told the story of one of the kids at a college raised his hand, and this was at Miami of Ohio, and the teacher asked, anybody voted for Trump? One kid said, well, I voted for Trump, and another girl in the class broke down and started crying and calling him names. And the teacher turns to the student and says, now you see how you made her feel. I mean, it's like, whoa, but it's this is a very divided country. There are competing worldviews. But let me put it this way. Donald Trump ran The Apprentice for a number of years on TV.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think Mitt Romney ever watched The Apprentice? Do you think Hillary Clinton ever watched The Apprentice? Do you think George W. Bush ever watched The Apprentice?
No.
I never watched the thing.
Right.
But Trump did this, and he had a connection to this middle America, if you will, that none of these other candidates had. It was more emotional than it was ideological, but he tapped it. He really understands that. He understood the media very, very well in a way those of us that are in New York or Washington or Silicon Valley or Hollywood didn't.
Right. So with the blue wall and Pennsylvania, Michigan, Wisconsin, and how that all played out, know, there's that frustration side of it. Is there also a piece to this? Is one thing I kept hearing from the analysts, Monday morning quarterbacking is, Trump had a message. It was unconventional for a typical Republican in terms of trade and those kind of things. But, on the flip side, an economic message or a vision didn't seem to resonate, with the core constituencies of the Democrats. Is that fair to say?
Well, I think it's very fair to say. The Democrats have put a coalition together of different interest groups, different groups who consider themselves a minority within the population, African-Americans, Hispanics, LGBT and the like. And now Obama was particularly situated and charismatic that he was able to raise the turnout with some of these groups. A lot of these groups, the turnout model is tough because it's for their transient populations. They move around a lot. They're hard to register and motivate to get out. She spent her whole campaign trying to replicate the Obama coalition, but she wasn't Obama. And what we knew from previous off-year election is Obama personally is very popular and is capable of getting these people out, but it's an Obama-centric coalition. This was hard to replicate.
Very personal, right?
Yeah, because in the two off years, 2010 and 2014, when Obama wasn't on the ticket, Republicans had really outstanding performances in the midterm.
Yeah, wasn't it historic in the House?
And historic in 2014 and the largest gain since 1938 in 2010. In fact, after the 2014 election, their state legislative participation was the highest since 1929, as was their House of Representatives. So you had these elements going in, and the Democrats said, we need to target and keep talking to these groups and get them out. I think the primary probably didn't help, Obama had the full 4 years to keep his coalition together. Hillary Clinton had to kind of reinvent it after the Democratic nomination fight.
Yeah. Just more local, it's kind of interesting. So I moved to Virginia, in the dark ages, I guess a long time ago, but let's say in the 80s, and even though they're Democrat, it's a very conservative state. To me, mm-hmm. coming from New England and the Democratic Party was transitioning to conservative Republican, that sort of thing. And it seems remarkable to me that you have Pennsylvania that goes for Trump and then, Virginia again goes for Clinton. Does that say,
Virginia, a third of Virginia is New Jersey.
Right.
I mean, just to put this in perspective, Northern Virginia votes a lot more like New Jersey. It's more a middle Atlantic, northeastern type because of the diversity of the population, the education levels of the population, and the like. The rest of Virginia votes more like Virginia, although we're seeing in suburbs around Richmond, Northern Virginia elements creeping in as people move from around the country into there, as the African-American population moves out from the city into the suburbs. That, by the way, we're seeing this around the country. So Virginia is really not a southern state. The southern parts of Virginia, if you will, that I-81 corridor and south side, Trump outperformed Romney and did enough to win had they been able to keep the traditional margins in Northern Virginia. But Obama carried Northern Virginia by 200,000 votes, and everybody thought that was a lot. Hillary Clinton carried Northern Virginia by 380,000 votes.
Wow.
So Trump got 29% of the vote in Fairfax County. So as you take a look at that, if Republicans now can't crack that, Barbara Comstock's reelect, I think you can give that to her personally, just really hard work over 2 years. And she did it without earmarks. Yeah. Frank Wolf and I had earmarks that we could bring back, as I was telling you, but I wasn't Tom Davis in the 11th District. I was Mr. Woodrow Wilson Bridge. I was Mr. Rayl to Dulles. I was Mr. You widen 123, you close the Lord in prison.
It's a great bridge, let me tell you, too.
Well, thank you very much.
So, hey, Tom, we do have to take our first break. My guest today is Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte, and we're talking about the 2016 election. And when we come back, we'll talk a little bit more about the election. I want to get his thoughts on the Electoral College and what all it means with popular vote versus the electoral vote. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte, and he's also a former congressman from the 11th District here in Northern Virginia. And Tom, when we took the break, we're talking about the election. I want to give you a chance to talk a little about some of the key states, some of the regions. Go walk through that a little bit, and then we'll get into maybe the Electoral College.
Well, the one thing I would note is the biggest differentiator now outside of race and ethnicity, where you still have a lot of block voting, is the education levels. And the states and the counties with the highest number of postgraduate degrees or graduate degrees voted consistently Democratic, and ones with the lowest voted consistently Republican. And Republicans can say this all the fears and we've harbored about over-education, you know, that's now confirmed with this.
That's those Ivy League education.
Exactly.
Or...
But it reminded me after Scott Brown won in Massachusetts, I talked to Ed Markey, who's now a senator, and mm-hmm. I said, Ed, what happened here? You know, and he just said, Tom, he said, people like you, you went to Amherst, I went to Boston College, they said most of them stayed on the Democratic side, but he said it's the people who went to these state schools and everything else in junior colleges. He said they voted consistently for Scott Brown. But what he was saying in a nice way is, you know, a lot of this is education level and worldview levels. That's mm-hmm. not to say there weren't Harvard people for Trump and there weren't people without college that went the other way. But as a general rule, there are worldviews that come out of this. Obama expounded on one, Trump another. And this was brought clearly when the contrast, just to show you, is Trump the other night was saying, you know, we have to be strong to bring peace. And Obama's yeah. saying, you know, we can't bomb our way. We have to negotiate our way out. Right. And so there's one side that thinks, you know, people are like us. And we can talk and reason with them and bring it through negotiation. The other side, no, what the world understands is that Mike makes right. And if you're not strong. Yeah. And they're just different worldviews at this point. There's probably a mixture of both in terms of what's best depending on different situations. But this was a competition of worldviews, and when you take a look at the political map, that's exactly what it was.
Right. So you're talking like the two coasts versus the interior.
The rural areas that Democrats carry are three types. There are just a handful of labor strongholds that stay Democratic when you get out into the mines in Minnesota, Superior, mm-hmm. Wisconsin, in northern Michigan. There's a little slice of it. But for the most part, rural areas are Republican through and through. Major exceptions, majority-minority counties. Black, Hispanic, Indian majority rural counties went Democratic, okay? Secondly, college towns. College towns are Democratic bastions. Of course, this goes to the graduate degrees and the education levels and worldviews.
Right. Like Charlottesville or...
Oh, right, Charlottesville was like 5-1.
Wow.
At that Amherst, Massachusetts. I went to Amherst College. Uh-huh. Amherst was like 9-1.
I won't hold that against you.
No. overwhelming. George Mason University, where I'm the rector and the chairman mm-hmm. of the board there, George Mason precinct was 75% to 10%. Although they defeated the meals tax, their students are still
right.
But these are worldview issues. And the third element of rural areas that Democrats tend to carry are these artsy communities. You get them in western Massachusetts, but it's mm-hmm. Aspen, Vale, Sun Valley, Idaho. Blaine County, Idaho, was a bastion of Clintonism, surrounded by these 75% Trump counties.
Yeah.
So it's you know that's the Democratic penetration list. Taos, New Mexico. Places like that. Even Summit County, Utah, voted Democratic for Hillary Clinton, as did Salt Lake.
Right.
In Salt Lake City, people think, well, it's a city. Cities are Democratic today. The largest city that was carried by Trump was Jacksonville, Florida. But Jacksonville, Florida is Duval County mm-hmm. and the city. It's kind of a unigov. If you look at the city part of that, it went heavily for Clinton. It's the farms and the outskirts that put Trump over the top. So we're really seeing these lifestyle, these worldview changes is what dictated this election. Now, the question is, does this happen in the next election? Is this continuing? And a lot of it will depend on how Trump proceeds as president. You know, who does he reach out to and what kind of coalitions can he hold or build?
Right. Well, as you know, when you think about that over the long term, too, I guess one of the things I always think about is demographics, right? As you know, the white population gets older, and you know, and as a percentage gets of the overall population gets smaller, at a certain point, you know, it seems to me that the Republicans need to think about a broader coalition. Or am I?
I think that's right. But and that was the thought this time is that this coalition, 70% of the turnout was white. It was 72% 4 years ago. But Trump did better among African Americans and Hispanics than Romney did.
And their
turnout models were lower as a percent of who they are. Obviously, the Hispanic turnout is growing significantly. I mean, one of my favorite mini facts is that in the District of Columbia, although Trump performed far worse than Romney, they're all asterisks in the Republican numbers in the city.
Yeah,
he doubled his percent among African-American voters. You say, Tom, really? And I said, yeah, because Romney got 0.8% of the vote in wards 7 and 8. Trump got 1.6%.
Wow. Hey, progress, right, I guess, exactly. From his perspective.
Yeah, the trend line is up.
Right, right. I have to ask you, the selection of Mike Pence in retrospect.
That was critical for him because it was his link to the Republican establishment, particularly the conservative establishment that has shoot him. Look, Trump ran with a lot of elected Republicans and Republican leaders openly repudiating him. Romney, Bush,
Kasich,
U.S. Senator. Yeah, U.S. Senators, people who'd been in the lead, not just Republicans, leading Republicans. McCain kept an arm's length. The Republican establishment, very weary of this guy. This guy was very stylistically different. Yeah. He came out of a different mold. McAuliffe got $25,000 contribution. The Democratic governor of Virginia got a $25,000 contribution from Trump. That would have sunk anybody else.
Right.
But again, this guy ran The Apprentice. He understood that connection. He understood that it wasn't partisan and necessarily ideological in terms of his appeal to people. No major newspaper outside of Las Vegas. No major newspaper endorsed Trump. So the press world, if you say the bubble world, the educated world, the chattering class, whatever you call it, none of them embraced him, and he still won. So this was an upheaval from the grassroots wanting change and willing to go with him. So he comes to Washington really not owing any of the establishment much.
Now, and what do you think that means moving forward in terms of...
Well, he's got a Republican Congress to deal with, and I think they're going to be writing most of the laws. I think it'll probably, for the most part, be a pretty mainstream Republican administration with a handful of Trump characteristics to it on trade and the like. So at least the rhetoric will clash with traditional Republican rhetoric, but that was part of his gift, is he could reach out to working-class voters that had shunned the party. The Republican Party is a country club party. Basically, your country clubs now are full of Democrats. It's completely changed, and it's been evolving over 20 years. This isn't just Trump. This has been evolving over 20 years.
Right.
But Trump just took it a step further than it's ever been before.
Do you see lessons learned from his approach? I mean, you know, it's interesting. One of the things says, you know, when you're watching the shows, and one of the observations was that, you know, when Trump announced expenses at one point, the campaign, and like the most money was spent on hats, right? You know, and people made, I guess, you know, the inside the bubble folks saw that as, what's the up?
Well, they were laughing at everything he did.
Yeah.
He's going over and opening up a golf course in Scotland instead of campaigning.
Right.
I mean, this is a very unconventional campaign, but again, this guy's a genius in a way. He ran The Apprentice. He understood that connection. In a way that the rest of us did not here in Washington. And the end result is he's the president of the United States. The question is what comes next?
Yeah.
But he beat everybody at their game. He won the nomination fair and square. But some of the liabilities that he had would have felled a traditional politician. His contributions to Democrats, the fact he didn't pay any taxes.
But he didn't release his taxes.
But he did. But when somebody leaked it,
probably
illegally. But when somebody leaked it, it was clear that he hadn't paid taxes, and he said, I'm not going to pay more taxes than I have to do.
Right.
I know how to close these loopholes because I used them.
Yeah, and I think people, that resonated with people.
Well, he didn't run and hide the way most politicians would cower in a corner and put out some apology statement, and I think. The fact that he went after the cons and he'd go after Miss Universe and these guys, most of us are like, gee, what kind of this is a character flaw. But for Trump, it's more like a business model. You know, this guy's a developer from the Queens.
Yeah.
I'll tell you a story. John Kluge was the wealthiest guy in Virginia.
Mm-hmm.
And in the divorce settlement with his wife, she was left this big farm in Charlottesville, and Trump came down and offered to buy it from her for $28 million. She said, no, she's going to run a vineyard, and this was going to be her afterlife. She runs it into the ground, and it goes up for auction. And Trump comes down at an open bidding, offers $6 million, and walks away with it. Nobody wanted to get into a bidding war with Donald Trump. So this has been his business model forever. He lashes back. If you punch him, he'll punch you back harder. And that's the way he's operated all his life. It's really never been successful in the political sphere, but given the unique environment we had this time, it worked for him.
Right.
It worked for him.
Yeah. Tom, we do have to take a next break. My guest today is Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. And when we come back, we will get into the Electoral College a little bit, and then we'll also start talk about what's coming next, just where the transition's going to go, and what we can expect from Republican president and Congress. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte, and we're talking about the 2016 election. And Tom, just let's talk a little bit first with just the dynamic of the Electoral College versus the popular vote, and Trump. What is it, 306, I think, something like that. And of course, you hear daily about how the gap in the popular vote continues to grow.
But that's as California comes in.
Yes, absolutely.
And you take California off, if you're trading, if you're the Republicans, you trade California for something else.
Because, absolutely.
but look, this is the second election now where the Republicans, just in this generation, where Republicans have lost the general election popular vote, but won the electoral vote. So it's no wonder you have people crying to change the Electoral College, but it isn't going to happen. You're not going to get 38 states to review this, and the Republicans aren't going to change a system that's working for them. And that's what that was the rules going in. Everybody understood it. What you have to ask is, why didn't Hillary Clinton get into Wisconsin? She didn't appear there once during the general election. Didn't they see that their blue wall was cracking? And I think they saw Pennsylvania, and they worked Pennsylvania hard, but she'd go into the major areas. I'm told the story that she was asked to speak at the St. Patrick's Day dinner in New York and didn't speak, and Bill Clinton said, "I'll take care of it." And he calls up the campaign chair and says, "Why didn't she speak in there?" They said, "Well, the white Catholics, that's not one of our target groups." So they were trying to work the Obama coalition, and they needed. Yeah. They took this base, people that had been voting Democrats for generations, but were increasingly alienated from the status quo, for granted. And Trump saw that opportunity and went right after him. And as I said, he ran The Apprentice. He understood these people, and just stole it right out from under him.
Right. Yeah, that's like it's Washington State, Oregon, and California.
The coast.
Oh, yeah,
there are four congressional districts that touch the Pacific Ocean that are held by Republicans in the House. One is in Washington State, one is Alaska, and two in California, Rohrabacher and Isa. And Isa almost lost.
Yeah,
these beach districts are just changing markedly. And so, look, these are, as I said, these are stylistic worldviews that are just very competing. People watch their own media, they get their own information, and they just view the world very differently. And this was a clash of cultures. And what the Democrats need to understand is that they let the Midwest slip out from under them, taking it for granted.
Right. And is that the big lesson learned for the Democrats?
I think I think both parties have to lose lessons, because the Republicans didn't get a majority. They were $2.5 million down in the popular vote, and they are non-competitive. In California, the Senate runoff was two Democrats. Do you want to be a regional party, or do you want to be a national party? These coalitions, in some ways, are not economic, but your very, very wealthy areas voted for the Democrat, and that's more a function of education levels than income levels. These coalitions, both parties have to look at their problems. Here's the short-term Democratic problem is the House is so gerrymandered at this point in favor of the Republicans. In 2012, Democrats got more votes for the House of Representatives than Republicans, but they were 33 votes short of a majority. It would take a switch of 17 seats to win it. And in the Senate coming up in this next midterm, you have 25 Democrats up, 10 of them in states Trump won. You only have 8 Republicans, only one in a state that Clinton won. Really only two competitive seats, theoretically, and that's Arizona and Nevada. So Democrats have a hard time taking the Senate back, and some of these Democratic senators are going to be voting with Trump because their states did. If you're in West Virginia or Montana or North Dakota, these are pretty big wins.
And on some issues, they'll whether it's trade or whatever, they're going to agree with him on some stuff, right?
Roger, I was in a Democratic seat in Northern Virginia. I was sitting there for 7 terms, and every chance I got to vote with the Democrats, I would highlight my independence. Mm-hmm. That was it. If I were Tom Davis just in a Republican box, I never would have gotten off the ground. In my old House seat, and in my wife's old state Senate and state House seats, Republicans didn't even run candidates in the last elections. They're not even running candidates in those districts now.
Yeah.
We held it by force of will and an individual brand, and that's just much tougher to do in today's environment.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about the, you know, the transition and what's going, I mean, and expectations with, you know, with the Republican House and Senate. And
a lot of groups that had worked on the transition were working with Christie's people. And when you had the coup right afterwards, right, all of a sudden there are people out in the street. In fact, yeah, you know, are persona non grata. So it's been a very interesting transition. But I think what we're seeing with Trump is what he, if you listen closely, what he said he'd do, he'd try to bring the best people from around and get them in. So I was quoted in the New York Times on Tuesday saying I was actually pleasantly surprised with the picks that he put forward at this point. They're quality picks. Elections have consequences. Democrats aren't going to like them, but that's the nature of an election. But they, for the most part, appear to be qualified. They have their own independent backgrounds that they bring to this and a level of prestige. And I think that's what you're going to continue to see. Now, it's a little bit outside the box. He's got a higher percent of military people than you would expect, I think, with an coming administration. But he doesn't know anybody, and I think he wants to run a good administration at this point. He's got to work with Republicans in Congress, and I think it will be a more traditional Republican administration with a few tweaks, Trump tweaks. I'd say it's a traditionally Republican administration with Trump characteristics, whatever that means, to be determined.
Right. So, and you mentioned in an earlier segment just the idea that, you know, that the House and the congressional Republicans are going to be, you know, so the authors of the policy and the
right. One of Trump's transition people talked about the tax bill. He said, "Well, the Ways and Means Committee writes a tax bill. You know, we sign it," recognizing that outsourcing most of that to Congress, and I think the Republicans in Congress, many of whom are not enthusiastic about Trump, are now pretty enthusiastic. Well, we're going to have somebody to finally sign our bills.
Right.
Now, the problem is governing is a lot more difficult than campaigning. And replacing Obamacare sounds great on the campaign trail, but what do you replace it with? How about these people that have gotten benefits they'd never gotten before? Do you just take them away? Mm-hmm. You have the same problem with DACA. That's the deferred action on children that were born, you know, in America, but whose parents came here undocumented.
Yeah.
Do you just throw these people out of college, make them ineligible for Pell Grants? I mean, you want to be careful about how you do these things. And so I think you got some smart people looking at what is the best way to bring about the changes that people want. There is obviously, after 8 years out of office, a lot of pent-up frustration among Republicans in terms of regulations and the things. And we can already see some of these things are turning around. If the courts haven't struck them, I think you live by the pen, you die by the pen. Some of these orders are going to get zeroed out the first day with Trump. Yeah. We don't know yet exactly what that's going to be.
Yeah, I'll go back to Congress, but that you brought up an issue. I'd be interested in your thoughts, just the use of the executive orders by the current president in terms of implementing policy, whether, you know, in the procurement world, you see things like the Fair Pay, Safe Workplaces rule, right, and narrow reporting. Yeah, do you have, just from a sort of constitutional perspective, any thoughts on that?
Well, sure. Look, first of all, I have a philosophical bent on these things. Yeah. I think I was out of Congress, so I favor Congress as an independent branch. This didn't start with President Obama. President Bush used this widely, mm-hmm, particularly once the Democrats took Congress, but he even did it with Republicans in Congress. So when you take a look at the number of executive orders and so on, I'm not sure that Obama did more than Bush, but they were a little more controversial.
Right.
And I think part of it came out of frustration. He couldn't move his policies through Congress once they lost the Congress. So you try to do by regulation an executive order and carry out your campaign promises. Makes sense. It's not traditionally the way it's been done, but it's been evolving in that way. But again, you live by the pen, you die by the pen. So once you leave, the next president has every opportunity to change those with the stroke of a pen. But look, Congress has become less and less an independent institution, as I noted at the first part of this program. The president's party in Congress has devolved to basically an appendage of the executive branch. And the opposition,
you mentioned, like,
party.
Less oversight of your if it's your president, more oversight if it's
a
party.
If you have a president with a different party than Congress, you tend to over-investigate him.
And if
it's your party, you tend to sweep some stuff under the rug. Mm-hmm. But it's not just that. It's legislatively, because of the way these districts are drawn out. In the House of Representatives, fully 80% of these seats are non-competitive in November.
Right.
We know which party's going to win them just by the nature of the way the district is drawn. And so there's very little incentive to compromise because members worry about their primary voters who don't like compromise.
Right. There's no consequences for voting against the president, but there may be consequences for voting for him if you're the opposite party.
Correct.
Right?
And also, bad behavior gets rewarded now. I always note that you get up and yell, "You lie," in the State of the Union. Had they done that 20 years ago, we'd take the guy to the woodshed and say, "You don't act that way."
Yeah.
And now you go on, on the media, you're a media star with part of the media. You go online, you raise $1 million of people who say, "Right on." So bad behavior gets rewarded under this. And I think Trump understood that. Some of the language that he used and the tone that he took. 10 years ago, nobody could have gotten away with this.
Yeah.
But in today's rules, everything is in play, and it gets rewarded, particularly in the primary process.
Right. So, Tom, this is our last break. When we come back, we'll finish up the show with Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. And when we come back, we'll continue our discussion of the sort of transition period, some of the dynamics of what we may see coming out of the administration and out of the Hill. You are listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Today, my guest is Tom Davis. He's Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. And we've been talking about the election. You know, we started to talk a little bit about Congress, the transition. And I guess one question I wanted to ask you about, you mentioned Obamacare and the dynamic of, you know, the great example you gave about, the tax law being written by the House where it has to originate, Trump, signing off on it. And that's the president's role to a certain extent, obviously. But there's dynamics and there's issues within the Republicans as well. And you have
freedom. Let me make two points. One is the Republicans, as everybody observed last time in the House, were a pretty divided group. Republicans couldn't get their act together. And the Democrats appeared to be kind of a monolith, and they behaved in a fairly predictable, consistent manner. I think you're going to see some reverse of that now, because with President Obama gone, he's the glue that held the Democrats together. You're going to see some of them running off in different directions now because they don't have a president holding their different coalitional groups together. Republicans now have a president to bring them together. Now, that doesn't end it. You still have a Freedom Caucus over there that will balk. But remember, most of these Freedom Caucus guys, the most popular politician in their district is Trump.
Right.
So
right.
When they balk at what Trump and Paul Ryan agree to, they're taking on the big elephant in their district.
Yeah.
And so I think you'll see that they still have to show relevance and they're still going to be barking. But yesterday they got rolled on a vote to impeach John Costigan and the IRS commissioner, as I think they should have. John Costigan, 77 years old. He's a very distinguished
long-time public servant.
Yeah. He came back in to make things better. He didn't create the problem there. Yeah, was he a little arrogant to Congress and didn't produce documents on time? Yeah, but if that's impeachable, you're going to have a long line. You'd have a long line, and it wouldn't start with John, who I think is in government for the right reasons. And it's also just a terrible message to send to federal employees.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these are people we rely on to carry out the policies that Congress passes. You don't like the policy, don't get mad at the people that are doing their job and implementing it under the law. So, look, I think with Trump coming in, you're going to see some difference in terms of how the bureaucracy works. They're going to, I think, make some effort to look at the federal pay structure and work rules and those kind of things. But I've always argued the fat in government isn't just cutting a program here or there. It's layered throughout government in the way we do business. It's people that are filling out forms that shouldn't have been printed, doing tasks that never should have been done in the first place. And that comes from Congress.
Yeah.
Because when there's a problem, you create some new task for Congress to perform, whether it's oversight or some level of transparency or reporting or something. You hire people, so you have people reporting and checking on the other person. And it doesn't make you a lean, efficient group. Now, we spend a lot of time making sure nobody can steal anything. but they can't do much of anything else either, given the
rules.
That's
a, you know, that is a great point. It is the, you know, are we spending dollars to save pennies in a certain sense? And I say that in the context of not only the cost of oversight. Right. Well, you know, nobody's going to disagree you shouldn't have oversight. But the, you know, the impact of it, the ramifications of it, the culture that it creates.
No, I've always argued, trust the guy at the window. You're going to lose a little money on that. You're going to get a little bit of corruption. You're going to get some bad issues. But you know, you make up more in the agility and the ability of government to innovate. Look, if you're not making mistakes, you're not innovating. That's the bottom line.
Right.
And we don't reward innovation in government for the most part. What we reward is mediocrity and staying in the lines and not making a mistake.
Right. We reward, in the procurement world, right, we reward process as opposed to results in many cases, most cases.
Absolutely. And the cartoon that captured it best was the two astronauts in their spacesuits. They're in the rocket ship getting go to the moon, and one looks at the other. He says, I sure feel better knowing this went to the lowest bidder.
Yeah. Yeah. So, just real quickly on regulations and, you know, and sort of tax policy, what do you foresee?
So the Republican narratives, and the Republicans, if they don't control the town, they preside over it. Their narrative is there's two taxes are too high and regulation burden is too onerous. So I think there will be a run on getting rid of a number of regulations. They may overdo it, which is the tendency in these issues. But I think they're going to take a run at a lot of these regulations that are making it harder for government to operate and making it harder for the private sector to operate. Look, it's a global economy. You can have all the trade laws you want, but it's a global economy and you're competing with firms that do not have the same regulatory and tax burden that we do. And so you lose out under that. That's why companies are going offshore.
Right.
They don't have to comply with our environmental rules and our labor rules and pay the same level of taxes they would if they did it in this country. So the narrative here is let's lessen that a little bit, and we'll take a little hit on some of these other issues, and you may get a little more corruption, but we have to compete and create jobs. And so I think you're going to see a run on a number of regulations at the congressional level, and I think you'll see a President Trump sign them.
Right, and you mentioned, you know, from day one, you know, certain executive orders that have led to regulatory.
And particularly on the labor side. I mean, overtime rules, those kind of things. Republicans are not believers in the minimum wage. They think it's a very artificial way that tries to manipulate markets have a number of unintended consequences. You know, I know the public tends to disagree with that, you know, when they come to referendum and so on.
Sure.
Economics is complex, but you'll find Republican regimes just less likely to go that direction.
Yeah. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, when we're talking regulations, the procurement system?
We have a lot. I think they're going to take a hard look at procurement at this point, recognizing, you know, that's where a lot of, if you call waste in government, that's where you can ferret it out, is in the procurement system. Again, you'll get some unintended consequences and you'll have some bad results out of that. But overall, they're looking at making some savings in these areas. We just saw Trump's tweet on Boeing, where he talked about, I don't know what the numbers, if they're right or wrong or whatever, but the reaction to that, this is a president that's not unwilling to take on programs that he doesn't feel are working and so on. So I think that signifies to me, at least, that they're willing to make some big changes in procurement. The question always is, what changes?
Right.
And how does it work out? And, you know, getting public policy right is very difficult. But I think you'll see changes.
Yeah. Well, you know, I'll mention one in particular. I mean, commercial item and relying more on the commercial market. I mean, commercial terms and conditions and that sort of thing. That's
of course
a big deal that when you mentioned innovation and the opportunities there.
You know, there's a reason that some of these companies do not sell directly to government.
Right.
Because they don't want to have to be subject to all the scrutiny.
Right.
And so you have resellers. You have Oracle resellers. You have Adobe resellers.
Yes.
They don't sell directly to the government. They make money on their products, but they don't want to have to revamp their whole financial systems just to comply with a lot of government reporting requirements.
Right. And, you know, I just think of FASA, right? And,
right.
Right. You're one of the authors of that, co-authors of that. And just the idea, you know, the you know, in particular, there's one provision, the ability of OFPP and the FAR Council to say, okay, this particular rule is, you know, it's almost default that it doesn't apply to a commercial item contract, a new rule or statute or whatever, unless there's a determination made that it's in the best interest of the government. That was put in the FASA to try to limit, you know, the
right,
application.
Right, to shift the burden on
right,
that.
Right, to say yes affirmatively. Well, that's become a rubber stamp, you know, over the years. That's literally, you know, there's two or three sentences they put in every rulemaking that says, yes, it's in the best interest. And that's about it. And they apply, I think, you know, so the
and it adds costs.
Yes.
Costs to government, and it takes out competitors who say, I'm not going to play that game.
Yeah. So there's an opportunity right there to just empower that authority again to take a look at some of this stuff.
But it's the nature of government. And by the way, it's the nature of Congress. I mean, people don't like to take risks. It's a risk-averse society. Private sector doesn't work that way. Private sector rewards risk.
Right.
We reward risk in our tax system, which is why capital is taxed at a lower rate than wages. But the government is just a very risk-averse item. One cabinet officer told me, he said, the mission is not to make a mistake.
Yes.
So you let the process drive this instead of outcomes. And I think you'll see some changes in this, but let's wait and see.
Right, right. And we could do a whole show. I think a lot of that's all about leadership,
mm-hmm.
right? And we could do a whole show on that. And I want to thank my guest today, Tom Davis. He's the Director of Federal Government Affairs at Deloitte. And you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show or any of our weekly programs anytime at federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM and federalnewsradio.com.